Hey, so this was a long conversation that we had with an audience with Tom from Durham Precious Metals on 2222022. And this is part three, the final part of the lengthy conversation with more things to talk about. Unbelievable how much there is to cover. And there's always more. So thanks for listening and being in touch, livingonpurposelyn@gmail.com. And durhampreciousmetals.com is Tom's website.
Anybody who has questions, feel free to call. Don't sit in the dark and do what some people have done and call me up and tell me you've been waiting 2 years to do this. Call me up and talk to me and let me walk you through it and buy an ounce of silver and take it home. And just get it in your hand and just go through the experience. It's not a lot. All the things that you thought were a big deal don't even exist.
Holding up something as an idea without believing it.
Yeah, we talked about that. So I've been researching all this stuff for a long, long, long time. And I've believed a lot of things over the years that I found out later just weren't necessarily true. And some of them were completely untrue. So you get tired of being wrong all the time. So I have a new philosophy, and the philosophy is the balloon philosophy. So if I hear something and I think it has any legs, I kind of just, in a virtual sense, just put it up there as a thought balloon. I don't necessarily believe it or completely dismiss it, but I just leave it there and I say, I'm going to look for more evidence for that. If more evidence comes along, I'll put a little more air in that balloon and it'll get bigger. And if I find out it's not true, well, I'll take the balloon down or put a pin in it. So I believe that we need to, I've heard it once said that true understanding comes from being able to hold a thought in your head and not necessarily believe it. So it's more of a thought experiment. Say, what if? Use your imagination. What if this is true? What if it's true? And just put those ideas up there. And that way you don't get too committed to being so wrong and dig your heels in on something so much. And it allows you the flexibility when new ideas come along to give yourself permission to just say, look, I didn't own that idea anyway. I'm just going to get rid of it. But the problem is we tend to own our ideas. They become part of us. They become part of our security. And when we're confronted with something different, we get very uptight and we can feel our security starting to slip away. But that's another illusion. Is that really our security? I extract security in a way from not knowing and always searching and looking for more evidence. So something people might want to try, just in my opinion.
You're more at ease just being open to exploring without feeling like you need to hold on to something.
Yeah, I mean, we'll temporarily, obviously, we have to hold certain thoughts for a while. We have to, you know, hold them closer, but I don't believe in making them part of us. They're just a thought. No matter how close we hold them, we should be able to take them and dispose of them as well. And I think that's a safe way to approach things.
It makes me think of sometimes conversations where, you know, somebody has to be right in one scenario, or both people are just open to exploring without coming to a conclusion, without one of them being more accurate or right than the other, like just being comfortable with that. I think there's a fair amount of trust in that because we tend to want to maybe believe we're a little bit smarter or feel maybe diminished if the other person appears to be smarter than us. And so I think there's a lot of trust in vulnerability of just exploring together in a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's understandable why people hold on to things tightly like that. But again, it is a practice. It's something you have to practice letting go. And if you have enough investigative curiosity, I think most people are eventually going to come to the same conclusion. Because you can't keep going on believing the same thing when you're a seeker and the information is speaking differently to you. That would be very confusing for me to have to hold on to an idea that all the evidence suggests is a different direction.
Well, that is true. Christina's coming back to our birth certificates being used as the gold that it creates, spends, makes, uses, invests, borrows, and steals money separate to us, the person.
Well, that comes down to the 1594 Sesta KV trust issue, which goes a long way back. And so if that is in fact true, I've never validated whether it's absolutely true, because who would you ask? And would you be able to believe their answer if they gave it to you? So it's one of those things that operates at such a high level. Who do you trust as an authority? You know, authority is a dangerous thing. You said that I was an expert at the beginning of this, and I always laugh because I remember heard a guy say one time, speaking from stage, he says, yeah, everybody says I'm an expert. And an X is a has-been, and a spurt is a drip under pressure. And I thought that was pretty funny. He goes, I'm no expert. I'm just a guy with some ideas. So I always go back to that. So again, the idea of authority, who would you trust again to have the answer to that? So we can look at all that evidence and we can say, oh, well, they've done this and they've bonded our bodies and pledged our bodies as an agreement to the debt. But I don't know, is that true or is it not? It all the evidence appears to be leading that way, but I have no way of proving it.
So I'm going to go back to Google and put my registration number in and take the time to follow that through a little ways and see where it goes. Because why would my registration number be double to another number that had nothing to do with me? Like, that just seems really quite odd, right?
Yeah, it is odd. I've never chased it down that finite of a rabbit hole, because I've held that balloon up too and said, okay, what if that is true? What does that mean? How is that necessarily holding us at a disadvantage?
Well, because we've been working off, they've been using us as leverage or, you know, as collateral. That's my understanding. Is it's like she said, I don't know about this coming in with $3,500 debt. I'm not quite sure what that means.
Well, that's just when you take the national debt and divide it by a number of people, probably as well.
Oh, okay. Called. Yeah. But this is like another step where you're put on the stock exchange and you're traded and stuff. And oh, that's what she said. Exactly. Yes. So yeah, just this sense that you're of value and that then there you are in servitude most of your life, just making enough money, you know, and if you make more than enough money, then, you know, you don't have the skills to deal with it because, you know, everybody's just sort of at a servitude level. So.
Yeah. And I think that's more a product of wanting to limit growth personally. I think some people in the world want to limit growth. And so best way to do that is just limit the access to things that would create growth. Very straightforward and simple. So, I mean, going back to that whole bonding system, if it is in fact the way it operates, again, I play devil's advocate and say, all right, so first of all, the good news is it proves that we're great collateral. We have lots of value, which goes back to my original labor is value. So check that box. But suppose it is that way. Well, is that affecting us directly in real time today? And I contend that it probably isn't. I think it goes a lot deeper than that. And I don't honestly know if I have the answer as to what it is. I'm still looking through my balloons to figure it out. Because every time I chase down these ideas and I say, okay, in practical terms, how is this affecting us? It seems on its face, because it's unusual to be, what do you mean they're using us as collateral? Well, aren't we the true value of the country to begin with, or whatever region we're assigning that to? And it's allowing them, if that's the case, to operate a banking system that we all have access to and that benefits us greatly in many ways. Again, I don't know if that's the problem. I think people like to put those things out there as the problem so we won't look at the real problem. Let's give them some decoys to chase so that they don't look at the real problem. Because a lot of times as I chase these things down, I find out, well, they could appear to be an issue, but if you really break down the system, are they? So I think there's something deeper beyond that we're not seeing.
Well, they may be wanting to cash us in. I mean, maybe we aren't of as much value anymore because we're taking up resources that they could use. Something that I just heard, like put together recently and something I was listening to that I had never thought of this before. You know, every company has a human resources department. Well, what else is resources? Like gas and oil and, you know, just think of any other resources.
Term collateral damage in war. What's being damaged? Humans. Collateral damage. Back to language again, right? That could be an accident. Maybe not.
Well, sometimes it's on purpose, but.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of times the language tells us the story.
Truly. Anyway, that human resources really caught my attention and didn't feel as helpful or supportive as it used to. Okay, Christina says, back to the birth certificate thing, it's an economic enslavement program. Only a few can benefit, and the corporations who were created to own and control all the resources, including humans, and we are the true value, and we are being used, abused, and now being made useless. They sold us to China.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. If you go back to how this all started, right? So we were basically living, you know, doing everything for ourselves and feeding ourselves and spending most of our time just existing. And then as things modernized, less and less people were needed to do basic food production or to do manufacturing. So there's a level of displacement, right, as society moves forward. So what do we do with the displaced people? They have to form some function. So obviously, as these farms and companies get bigger and bigger and less people, like obviously farm machinery allowed one man to do the work of thousands. So what do we do with the thousands that still exist? So they become service people to service the growth of these original industries. And as you play that out, you get to a point where we have so much that's computerized and so much automation available to us. Computers can do the work of tens of thousands of people eventually. So yeah, in some sense, many of us are not going to be needed, but we do exist. So now what, right? Many of us are going to have to find ways to carve out a place in the world instead of relying on the system to give us a place, to give us a job. We're going to have to become more self-sufficient, more creative, find more ways to make ourselves valuable where we are being replaced by machinery and automation. And so this is where the unending creative ability of human beings, I think, is going to be stressed to the max in coming years.
Well, yeah. And I think those of us who've had the experience of pivoting through different changes where it wasn't so up against us, I think that has been good practice for when it really comes down to it.
I think Clint Eastwood in The Bridges of Madison County had it right when he said, change is the one thing we can count on. Once you realize that, you take comfort in it instead of being afraid of it. Most of us are afraid of it. And of course, because we've worked very hard to eke out this small bit of comfort in this place in the world. And when that becomes threatened, it's quite disconcerting.
Especially over this last couple of years, so many people who were working, maybe they didn't like what they were doing, but for many people, their work has changed. And maybe to something they used to do, something they've only started to do. It has been an opportunity. It still is an opportunity to really look at what the meaning of life is and what really gives our life meaning. Dr. Jordan Peterson said, life isn't made up of matter. It's made up of what matters.
Brilliant guy. We should be proud that he's a Canadian.
Oh, I think we are listening to him more and more. Hey, I have this thing I wrote down, and maybe this makes more sense to you. Sin is debt.
Yeah, so that would get back into biblical terms. I mean, oftentimes, if we look at things through a different filter, if we say, okay, let's read the Bible again and use this filter, let's see how much economics is in the Bible. And if you actually read it with that filter, you'll find out there's an awful lot of economics in there. Mm-hmm. Right? Same with law. If you look at it as law, right? There's an Old Testament quote that I just love because I spent a lot of time learning about law. And if you look at the King James version of it, it's Proverbs 9:10, and it's knowledge of the holy is understanding in the King James, which sounds very vague to me. Like, what is the holy? What do you mean by understanding? You know, how do we break that down? So it sounds like a very vague term. But if you go back to the Septuagint, which is the Old Testament's first translation from Hebrew to Greek and then to English, which those languages translate very, they actually transcribed it. They didn't translate it. There's a difference. Translate means there was no correlation between this word in this language and this language. So we had to guess. That's translate. Transcribe means, yes, we have a word in this language and a word in this language that mean the same thing. So we just substitute the word. In the Septuagint, the phrase is, knowledge of the law is one of the conditions of a sound mind. Now, there's a maxim in law that says specific evidence overrules general evidence. Which one of those is more specific? It's obviously the second one. So it would be the truer one in terms of law. So in fact, when you hire a lawyer, you become non compos mentis, which means not mentally competent. So in fact, the Bible, the Old Testament, told us the truth, which we're still telling today. Up until 1953, the book of Hebrews was taught in Harvard Law School as the first course. So a lot of our law does in fact come from the Bible.
Wow, so we'd have to explore the language in the Bible then just to see how well it's been brought forward or
corrupted.
Or, yeah, corrupted.
As I just demonstrated, right?
Obscured, yeah. Yeah.
So if you take away the solid specific meaning of things and replace them with allegory and complexity and vagueness, you're really not communicating anymore. It's just words on a piece of paper. So yeah, getting into that whole sin and debt thing, there are some who believe that the original meaning of the word sin was actually debt. Now, I don't know how we would corroborate or prove that. You'd have to go through a lot of scrolls and be a real linguist in order to do that. But there are some who have done that research, and that's what they firmly believe. And many believe that a lot of the allegories in the Bible are very similar to that, that in fact, they're saying something different than what they appear to on the surface.
Oh, well, that's for sure. There's that whole parable of, I don't know it exactly, but the idea that if you can be responsible for a small amount, you'll be given more.
Yeah, the 10 talents story. The master gave his servant it was 5 talents, and the other he gave 4, and the third one he only gave 1, and the fifth one invested the 5 and came back with 10, and the other came back with, and the one buried his and came back and said, I preserved this for you, here's it back, and he said, give that talent to the man with 10. So it's really about meritocracy, those who can do and increase, and again, it's more of a philosophical position, but yeah, there's a lot of that kind of stuff in the Bible.
Well, yeah, and then there's the other one, like where you squander, like can you be trusted to, well, maybe that's sort of mixed up in that one, but what brought that to mind too was just the idea that if you squander, you don't take responsibility, then you feel like you've sinned. And part of that is a feeling of debt that you owe something.
Yes, that could definitely be interpreted that way, I would think, yeah.
Yeah. Now, something you haven't talked about, Tom, I don't think, and I don't know at this stage of the game, if you want to get into this idea of the fractional reserve banking.
Yeah, the whole idea of fractional reserve banking.
Like, what is that?
There's actually a working paper on the Bank of Canada website. I actually did a video on this years ago, and I stumbled onto this document, which basically says we do not use fractional reserve banking.
What is it though?
Fractional reserve banking is the concept that if we're going to create currency and quote unquote loan it, that we need to hold back a specific amount of that as a reserve. Well, it seems a little silly to me in a way. The stuff has no value over time anyway. So what good is a reserve of something that has no value? How does that substantiate the system and back it up? Unless it's backed up with something of substance, which it's clearly not. So I know in Canada and most of the other Western countries, they in 1991, 2, and 3, they phased that out and went to a system where they can loan as much money as you can qualify for. So we provide the assets. So either in terms of we have a steady employment that we can show a track record of having enough resources to distinguish that debt, or we have the assets, right? So that's kind of how the system is undergirded now instead of this reserve system. And then if you stop and think about it, to me, I mean, the more I looked at that, I mean, my initial reaction to it was, this doesn't seem right. But the more I dug into it, I thought, well, of course, if we're trying to move an economy forward and people have a desire to do work and a desire to build and a desire to create, there should be as much currency available for that if it's a reasonable project as is available to them. So if the individual can back that up and substantiate it with their own value, completely makes sense to me. So I don't know where the problem is in that. I can't see it. So obviously I believe the problem lies somewhere else, and I haven't quite sorted that out yet, but I don't believe that is the problem, although many people do. This fractional reserve lending, they just repeat it over and over again. And I go, okay, so why is that a problem? And nobody can really explain it to me. So if they can't substantiate and explain it when questioned, then obviously there's flaws in their logic.
Yeah, or there's just, you know, it's repeating something that doesn't necessarily, like that needs review and needs refreshing as a concept and as a practice, perhaps. Yeah.
Yeah, I call it getting past the first layer. Like when we discover a new reality and something else, we often get married to that first layer that we discover and never consider that there might be something deeper than that in there. And I mean, that's normal. You know, when you find something that's very unusual, and many of these ideas are very unusual when you hear them the first time, they're almost a little unbelievable. But we have to look at them, in my opinion, in practical terms and see, are they really, you know, as bad as they appear to be? And in many cases, I found that they're not necessarily bad at all. They're just different than what people believe a system should be.
You know, I'm thinking about our relationship with money as a concept and how, like you say, we think about it, we talk about it. It's a big part of our orientation in life. And so even as we find out more of the underpinnings of how things work, or, you know, maybe how things could be better, I think ultimately it's important that we feel good about ourselves with whatever that system is, that we don't hinge our feeling about ourselves so closely with whatever all that element of life is. Because ultimately, my psychic friend says that when she's speaking to people who've passed, they never talk about money. Like, that's not an issue, you know? And so it's like a funeral procession going down and a U-Haul truck following it, you know, with piles of silver or whatever. And it's not going, you're not taking it with you.
No, we're not taking it with us. Expression, right?
So let's feel good now, right?
Yeah, it's the old deathbed confessions thing that nobody ever, you know, says I should have spent more time at the office, right?
Yeah.
But in the moments when there's, you know, something happens in our life and we're emotionally attached to it, it's very hard to step back and in the moment and say, well, when I'm on my deathbed, I'm not going to care about this. Maybe we should do that more often, but
just to get perspective on things. Any pictures, I'm looking at people, some questions, anything to throw here at Tom?
We must have done a good job. We've answered all their questions.
Maybe everybody's just stunned.
How about you? You got any questions? Putting all the pressure on you to do all the work. You got to be the ringleader. Now the pressure's on.
Nobody's stepping up. Anything?
Okay, I have a question then.
Oh, somebody's stepping up.
You know, I've been mostly listening and entering in my little bits. I'm a little jaded with this subject of the monetary system and happy to see the end of it, actually. But I'm just wondering, as we're transitioning into new exchanges and new forms, which I think are going to be more about the currency as relationship, as the new currency really is how we value each other, is much greater than how we value a piece of paper. But I'm just curious about how, if you stock up on gold and silver and these hard assets, these physical ones, what are you going to do with that when you have to travel or move, or like when you need to buy something, what are you going to do? Just cash that in? Like, how does it really serve to have those hard assets? Because you still need a bank that'll take them, or a company that will buy them, or like you're going to go buy a loaf of bread with a silver coin, or how does it work?
Right. Yeah. And a lot of people ask that question. It's becoming more relevant than ever now. So part of my answer, nobody's going to like to hear. And part of my answer is, it's up to you. And that is something that's hard for people to hear, because we really, whether we realize it or not, have relied on a lot of other people to decide for us what to do in these situations. And so now we're confronted with an upset of the system and looking at the very real reality that we may actually have to transact in different ways. And that's going to be difficult. So let me speak to it in some possible scenarios. So if we don't have a complete Mad Max breakdown of our systems due to various different problems that we've set in motion, then more than likely what people will do with their gold and silver is just store up economic energy in it so that they can bypass the effects of inflation, which are clearly coming. I mean, we see it in gasoline already, 60% inflation year on year. So it's clearly coming. It always starts in certain assets and progresses through the system. So gold and silver aren't going to be a be-all and end-all to anybody, and I never suggested they will. They're only going to be part of a toolkit. And the primary thing that they will allow people to do is transcend those inflationary periods, at least to some degree, if not wholly. If not, if we have a revaluation of them to benefit greatly from the other side of this when we shake some of these problems out. So I don't know if that fully answers your question, but most people in a scenario where we don't hit Mad Max are probably going to cash the silver and gold in incrementally and use the currency immediately so that they can bypass that inflation. I just read a book on the Zimbabwe hyperinflation, and it was either 09 or 10, they hit, and this is an absurd number, 89.7 sextillion percent inflation, like completely absurd. Go look up the $100 trillion notes from Zimbabwe and go to images online and you'll see for yourself how absurd it got. But the real problems were actually structural problems where people simply couldn't buy from stores anymore because the stores all went bankrupt because they couldn't price their products properly. Because at the beginning of the day, they'd be one price and at the end, they'd be another. And they were constantly playing catch up. Everybody became an inflation expert. That's all the public talked about. It's a fascinating read. It's a book called When Money Destroys Nations by a fellow that lived through it. I don't necessarily expect that that's going to happen at that scale here, but let's say we have 100% inflation a year. Just having some gold and silver is going to transcend some of that, at least in the short and medium term, and even more so in the long term. The longer that goes on, the more it's going to help you transcend that. So it's more of just one of the tools in your toolbox than a panacea, you know, complete solution. There's no one thing, in my opinion, that is a complete solution. And most of your is going to come from here. This is your best tool right here, is your brain and your willingness to adapt, because things are going to change and they're going to change pretty constantly, I believe, over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. Adaptability is almost more important than anything else.
Your answer is really appropriate because we were talking about that earlier. We're used to giving our autonomy away in terms of experts and people who we think know more about it, but we do have our intuition and our gut feeling. Now, we have a question here. How would I go about telling other people how your store works and how to buy gold and silver? I know some people who want to buy and they just don't know how.
Yes, and that is a big issue. A woman called me the other day and basically announced on the phone, you know, I've been thinking about doing this for 2 years and haven't acted on it yet. And I thought, isn't that interesting? What is stopping her? Now, of course, I'm not going to embarrass somebody. I never do. When people come to me with this sort of sheepish, I don't understand anything, I try to be as magnanimous as I can be because I remember being in that position once upon a time and not understanding and not knowing. So what I try to say to people is it's not complicated. You simply give me currency and I give you gold or silver. That's it. And now, of course, there are layers of complexity above that, but reduced to its simplest form, that's it. You walk into our store with cash, you walk out with silver and gold. Anything above and beyond that is a different conversation that's more personal to the individual, which of course, those conversations we do have because people come from different backgrounds and have different needs. And of course, I can't give them financial advice, but I can talk about why to have different increments for simple practicality things. So most of the considerations are actually really, really simple. You can reduce them down to two or three things. You're trading cash for metals. Increments are important. Gold and silver, either or, both are good. I personally believe silver has more potential upside. That's another thing I always say to people. And so at that point, now you have a few things in your toolbox to make a decision. The challenge at that point is, are people satisfied with that answer? Do they feel that there's more to it than that? Because if you come to it with the feeling that it's complex, a simple answer may feel like it falls a little short. But the fact of the matter is, it's our own imagination of, you know, what might be that causes that confusion rather than the actual answer. It is a very, very simple process. So once people get past that emotional gestalt and just act on it, like I've always said, it's easier to act your way into a new way of feeling than to feel your way into a new way of acting.
Wow.
Take a step, see where you go.
It's true. Everybody starts somewhere. I didn't know too much about it at first, and I went and got a few coins, and then I went through somebody else who was referred to me and got some more coins. And then I thought, surely there's someone close to me. And I Googled and I found Durham Precious Metals. And I went over to Whitby and I met Tom. And then I went over a few months later and I met Tom's wife, Virginia. And I've just been gradually getting different things incrementally. And so now I feel like I've got a good assortment of the usual currency I'm familiar with and some other items of coins and bars. And that just feels good. It feels like realistic. It definitely is a strange thing to do at first, but it feels like it's something that is of value, whether I cashed it in at some point or I just, here's a question. Okay, so I paid a certain amount for this. Do I have to base it on the value that I paid for it? Or could I, you know, if I was going to use this in exchange for something, can I put a different value on it? Who's going to tell me I can't?
All values are relative, in my opinion. So, and here's an illustration for that. What's a hacksaw worth to somebody? What value does somebody put in a hacksaw? Well, a plumber might want to pay $17.99 for a hacksaw to cut plastic pipe. But if you were locked in a room that somebody set on fire and you were chained to a bench or something, a workbench, and they set the room on fire, how much would a hacksaw be worth to that person? So in that sense, it's relative to the situation and the two people. I had a friend who was a real businessman, and years ago, he was debating with somebody over buying a trailer on the phone. He said some very harsh things to this guy. And I thought, wow, I don't know. That's pretty harsh. I don't know if I like my friends being that rude to people. I felt like I lost a little respect for the guy. And when he got off the phone, he said, it's only worth what someone's willing to pay for it. And I thought, well, you've got me there. You got me there. So each individual in the transaction, it's relative. Now, given that silver sort of has a benchmark standard for it, the spot price is kind of the standard that it's all measured by. Obviously, we can take some cues from that when we disagree with others. But in fact, there may come a time when that all disappears and we are going to have to rely on ourselves for that again. And this is something that I even stop and think about and go, in that situation, you know, philosophically, what do I believe in about that? And I still haven't formulated a final answer to it, to be fair. I wish I had. I wish I could give you an answer. But in the interim, in the meantime, I think it's important to look at maybe the dollar value of it today and benchmark it against some other things of like, what's the minimum wage now and how much is silver? So maybe an ounce of silver is 3 hours of minimum wage for basic labor, right? Because that is a kind of a standard that the employment industry uses and labor industry uses as an hour of labor, right? So we're probably going to have to look at it somewhere along those lines in order to have some sort of agreement so that we don't have to, you know, get into a dispute when we're trying to do a transaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm keeping track of what I paid for things. And of course, you know, then you can look at the value online, you know, or at your store on your website, you know, you can look and see what the going rate is. So if you bought silver back, like, would you pay me what the going rate is or what I paid for it?
This is a question a lot of people ask. And this is something most bullion dealers will never tell you. Mm. So people say, well, if I buy this from you today and sell it back to you tomorrow, will I lose money? And I say, yes, you will. Because typically it's bought back at the spot price and there's a retail price because, well, the stores have to move it around. It has to be couriered. It has to be stockpiled and have to keep the lights on and pay the rent. So there's going to be a premium cost on top of that. And that's what allows the system to get it to where you can purchase it. Often when people complain about that, I have to do a long explanation about it because they feel like, well, that's a little nefarious. And I say, well, I could be rude and say, well, here's a shovel. Go dig up your own. You know, that would be one way to express it. Of course, that's a little coarse. If I was talking to a friend who was arguing with me, that might be the tact I'd take. I'd say, here, go dig up your own, Ralph. But on a more softer note, of course, I don't believe that because it's impractical and silly. But on a more practical note, I personally believe the inflation rate now, based on some stats I've seen, is probably on the order of 20-25%. So let's say you're paying, you know, a 15 to 20% premium on the gold and silver right now. Well, first of all, one thing I said to one guy one day, I said, well, don't you think short-term thinking is the reason we have the problems we do in finance? And so he had to kind of pause. I said it nicely as a question. He went, yeah, I get your point, but I still want an answer. How much would I lose? And I said, well, you'd lose, you know, about 15%. And I said, how do you feel about that? He goes, not very good. I said, so are you done now? Are you not going to buy anymore? And he says, well, so I talked with him for a while and we were done. He was, oh, okay. And now I get it. I said, look, if you were to invest in mutual funds, is there a cost to that? If you use a broker or a planner, yeah. What's your cost for a broker? Is it, what, 1.5% trailer fees a year? That's going to add up over 30 years. And you really should be looking that long with any of our financial plans if you want to be successful. It's short-term thinking that is the killer of great financial ideas. And I said, so you're going to pay way more than that in fees over time. I said, the good news with this is you pay it all up front and you're done. And now if let's say we have 20% inflation this year and there's a 20% premium over spot, you're going to break even in the first year because if you held on to your dollars, you're going to lose 20% of them anyway in purchasing power. The reason we don't notice that is because the number stays the same. If we actually took the dollars and threw them away, then we'd have a real attachment to it. So you're going to lose that value over a year anyway. At least by buying the gold and silver, you're going to be at the even at the end of the year. And then you can begin the progress of repair, of keeping pace with inflation from there forward. So a year in, you're not going to notice that change and that loss. All right. So he immediately bought another 100-ounce bar after that 10-minute explanation. He went, that was very honest, he said. Another fellow walked in the store, he goes, this guy's a great guy. He's really honest. Okay, all right, enough of the admiration. You know, but that is something that is a fact in the industry, and it's something we have to look at. Now, in an inflationary environment where like we're in right now, it's almost a foregone conclusion that it's not going to matter real, real soon. Also speaking to that, if you want confirmation of the inflation rate, there's a guy named John Williams who has a site called Shadow Stats. And what he does is he takes the calculation that the government used in 1980 and redoes the inflation index with that number. And he says right now, inflation is probably on the order of 15% using government stats from 40 years ago. So that's very telling. And if that's true, then what is the real number?
Yeah, for sure. Is it fair to compare buying U.S. currency and then selling U.S. currency? Is that kind of like that's similar too? You can't just go and buy it and then sell it and expect to get your money back, right?
No, yeah, obviously. But the fees on it are much smaller because you're dealing with a digital product, which has no, you know, movement costs. You can move digital stuff for a fraction of a joule of electricity, you know what I mean? A fraction.
No, but if I was going to go into the bank to buy U.S. money and then take it back in the next day, I wouldn't be.
Yeah, there'd be a loss on the forex exchange. Yeah. Now, of course, again, it wouldn't be as big of a loss as something physical. Now, obviously, bills are physical, but they're printed by machines and you can add zeros to them easily and make a $50 bill, a $500 bill with one zero. So you don't have the structural costs with that. But again, even without the structural costs, there's a fee because you're dealing with an institution who has to pay for the lights and if you can walk in that door and do that transaction and pay the people. So there's always going to be a cost involved in moving things physically or doing any kind of transaction.
So that guy who bought a 100-ounce bar, like how come he didn't buy smaller increments? You didn't talk him into that?
I talked to him about it, but he was pretty settled on the 100-ounce bar. So, hey, if that's what you want, I mean, I do have that car. Would you consider buying some 1-ounce down the road? You're going to have to bring in that big brick and take all. He was fine with it. So
well, it's a good doorstop.
Yeah, they do make a good doorstop.
I think it's a part of the consumerism. Everybody's taught to gain money and spend it immediately. Don't put money aside because you don't need it. We are happy in this moment. So I think this is part of the education. And this is why people don't put money aside. They don't think about tomorrow and is no education on how to save money and what will be later, like how you plan your future.
So true.
Like with the law, everybody that no Canadian knows the law right now, like nobody, because nobody was taught in this thing. These are subjects that should be brought at school level, I think. What are your rights? What are your duties as a Canadian citizen? The same with the economic system.
Yep, very true.
Yeah, so many aspects to it. In school, money and finance or something should be a required course, you know, you'd think.
Yeah, you would think so. But then again, you got to understand, I mean, the education model was built to serve a different world. right? A lot went into that education model, whether you agree with it or disagree with it. And it did fulfill a role for a time. You know, most people were looking for employment. So what do? We teach them how to be a good employee. And so we build our education model around that. And it's generally worked okay for most people. So why would they stop it, right? Well, we don't need to teach them that stuff. They can figure that out on their own. So that's where we're at. We're really, individually, we're remiss for not picking up the ball and looking further into our own. Like, personally, I believe that education is what you decide to look into on your own. Everything else is just vocational training. It's just to get you to, you know, the job and get you so you can do the things necessary to feed yourself and have shelter and all that. The education begins when you go beyond that, personally, I think.
Well, that's an interesting distinction. Yeah.
My own personal distinction, but I think if you break it down and look at it that way, you find that people that have gone ahead and done that usually tend to be more successful. Like people that question things and say, maybe I'll look for a different version of that reality or truth, you know, and are willing to put the time and effort into that level of education usually fare pretty well.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of talk recently about school and education. Well, you know, the schooling system and what they're bringing into it. And in a way, a good thing that more homeschooling is starting now because of the situation. I think that's actually a positive thing.
Certainly can't hurt. And the thing is, too, is if you send your kids to school, why would we need to educate them, right? They're getting what they need. That's the natural presumption. Okay, yeah, they're being taught and they're, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic, good to go, right? The basics, right? So parents have kind of stopped picking up that ball and teaching different values. And generationally, if you're not taught these things, then you can't pass them on either.
Yeah, well, that's true.
So let me speak to something that is a little more positive, because we've been talking about a lot of stuff that's kind of dark and sort of foreboding. So let's talk about something positive for the metals market. So here's kind of my opinion on where we are in the terms of the metals market. So we're going into an age of solar electricity and electric cars and things like that. So let me put a few statistics out there. So right now we mine 800 million ounces of silver annually. And that mine supply is mostly spoken for, if not entirely spoken for. There is no surplus anymore. Up until about 10 years ago, there used to be a surplus, but that's disappeared. So silver is price suppressed. There's a function called the COMEX, and the COMEX is where they trade paper silver. Now, when they do these trades, they're in increments of, I think, 5,000 ounces or what they call 5,000 units. So what's happening is that on this COMEX, they're actually trading the product, but they're not delivering the physical metal. They're simply allowed to cash out in dollars. Now, anybody who knows anything about investing knows that when you buy a short, that's a signal to the market and to others in the market that you believe the price of something is going to go down. And so the system responds to that and holds the price down. Now, despite that, silver and gold have outperformed the S&P index for 20 years straight, but they're still undervalued due to suppression. So where are some of the structural things that I think are going to be positive for a silver price, you know, an outbreak on the price? So number one, silver and gold come out of the ground at approximately 8 to 1. So for every ounce of gold that's mined, about 8 ounces of silver are mined. Now, being that they're very similar in their qualities and very similar in their uses, you could easily interchange gold for silver in, say, electronics, but it's extremely expensive. And right now it's 79 to 1, the price of silver. So for every ounce of silver, the gold is 79 times more expensive. Now, based on what I just said of that 8 to 1 ratio, shouldn't the numbers be closer to 8 to 1? So if you do a calculation on that and you hold that gold is a correct number, or at least, you know, correct for the most part, silver should actually be at that 8 to 1 ratio, about $300 an ounce. Now, it's the price suppression that's stopping that. So the price suppression, they also engaged on palladium in price suppression. Now, if you go back in a historical chart on palladium, if you go back to 2011, I believe it was $700 an ounce. It's somewhere on the order of $3,000 an ounce now. And they're not manipulating it as much anymore. So that's what happens in a price outbreak when the manipulation goes away. That's one factor. The fact that they're going to be using, they're pushing so hard for electric cars and solar panels and solar electricity, there's a huge demand on silver too, with no feasible substitute. So right now, they're producing about 5 million electric cars a year and using approximately 100 million ounces of silver. So 90 million cars a year are sold on the market. And they're saying by 2030, they want it all to be electric. So wouldn't we need at least another 800 to 900 million ounces of silver if we're using 100 million to make 5 million cars? Do the math on that. We're going to need the mine supply that we have right now, again, just for the electric cars, and more so for solar panels. So how do we solve this problem? We don't, and here's why. 80% of silver is mined as a byproduct of mining copper, zinc, and lead. You're not going to call up Rio Tinto and say, please ramp up production so we can have more silver. It's not going to happen. So that's out. So now we're reliant on the 20% of mines that are silver-only mines. If you ask Keith Neumeyer from First Majestic Silver how long it takes to bring a new line on, it's 10 to 20 years. So even on the lower estimate, we're still not going to make 100 million cars by 2030. So that's a fantasy. The only way any of this is ever going to change is if the price goes up to the point, like right now, you can bring me in plated silverware. I can't buy it from you because the chemicals to extract the plate off of the metal cost more than the silver that you get. The only way that's going to change is if we get rid of the price suppression, allow it to come to its natural price so that we can now have enough resources to extract it all out of the landfill sites. We're throwing away cell phones with silver in them, computers with silver in them, headlights with silver in them. Silver is being thrown away constantly in landfill sites, but there's no economics in getting it out. We need a price increase. So being that 60,000 products that we rely on that have no other substitute require silver, do you honestly think Chinese manufacturing, which is where most stuff is manufactured, is going to tolerate a silver shortage in those factories? That would be absolute catastrophe. So something has to give. We simply can't go on with these various different mechanisms pushing and pulling at the precious metals price if we want to move forward into this world that they're planning for us. It's just not going to happen. Like when you look at those numbers, that's absurd. So something has to break and turn that around, or otherwise there's going to be some much bigger problems as I see it. Now, that's negative on one side, but clearly that has to be solved. So that's a positive signal for silver to eventually say, I can honestly see Chinese factories literally creating a parallel system where they say, we'll buy silver from you directly, to heck with the COMEX, to heck with the spot price. Here's what we're paying. I envision a day when that could happen if we don't do the things necessary to break silver and gold out of this valuation system they're stuck in.
Why the suppression?
Well, silver is negatively correlated to the dollar. In reality, precious metals are still, in an indirect way, the basis of our financial system. They really still are. Now, that's a convoluted understanding and a deep dive to get into that. But suffice it to say, it is still worked that way because it is expressed in dollars.
And this was where you and I started talking last fall. And I asked you that. And you said it's something you've been studying and wondering about for quite a while, about how to value this apart from dollars. That's an ongoing conversation.
And the dollar is another conversation. The dollar is not a fixed standard. It was under the Constitution in the U.S. They actually made it a fixed standard. I forget how many grains it was, but it's a certain number of grains of pure silver or a certain number of grains of gold. So we actually had it fixed to something of substance. The definition of a dollar now is 100 cents. The definition of a cent is 1/100th of a dollar. That's circular reasoning. That means there is no definition. It's a floating, unfixed standard. Here we are measuring our finances and our value equation in our life with a non-fixed standard. How are you supposed to know where you're at any given time if we can't peg that to something in reality that we want and need, such as housing, gasoline, food? So the dollar is a very illusory thing that allows a lot of magic tricks to go on, suffice it to say, because it's impossible without pegging. I actually have a website that I spend a bit of time on looking, and it's called pricedingold.com. You might want to check that out. It's kind of interesting. It shows all these various indices of things that are priced in. Well, how many ounces of gold would it take to buy the Dow or wheat or, you know, so that would give you some really good relative values of pegging something of substance to something else of substance, because true wealth is substance. Of course, it can be ideas and it can be our brain as well, but most true wealth is substance.
Substance. Yeah. So, but what about labor?
Well, labor makes substance. So it's a facility that creates substance. In a sense, you know, ideas are substance too. I don't just mean physical substance, because an idea is, of course, have valuable, right?
And then whether you believe that idea or not has value.
Exactly. Yeah. If a group of people believe something is a worthwhile idea, then it has value and substance.
Oh my goodness. So more questions before we wrap up. It's like 2 hours.
Yeah, we're 2 hours now. We're deep into it.
Deep into it. We keep getting to the money.
Yeah, you could go on for a long time.
And it's an ongoing conversation. Yeah, Christina says she doesn't want to move into the world. They are planning for us. That's why we need our autonomy.
For sure.
So any questions? Last call for questions. Hello.
Again, we must have covered everything.
I guess we must.
Mission accomplished. We should reduce it down to a book. And
hey, what about buying gold jewelry?
Yes, we do buy anything that has silver content for scrap to recycle. Now, in fact, recycling is where I think about 20% of the metals in the industry come from, if my memory is correct. If you want to see a humorous version of that, just go watch South Park's Cash for Gold episode. It's quite humorous and actually fairly close to the truth. It's just a constant, never-ending recycling. People break a piece of jewelry. They go in and somebody says it's going to cost $600 to fix it. They figure, heck, I didn't pay $600 for it 5 years ago. I'll be darned if I'm going to pay $600 to fix it. Next thing you know, it's on our door and they're getting $500 for it. So it's a good system. It works. It allows, you know, people to get rid of things that are useless and allows us to recycle them and put them back in the system so others can enjoy them.
Okay, so turning that around, she's wondering, what about me buying the jewelry?
We don't do any sales of jewelry. We just deal with scrap. It's just a natural byproduct of the industry. When we started, we had no intention of doing it. We thought, you know, that cash for gold thing's a bit lowbrow and stuff. But when you realize people are asking you about it all the time, you say, well, if we're being asked about it every seventh person, I think maybe we need to change our position on it. And you realize that it really is just a recycling system, just straight up recycling. It's no different than recycling aluminum cans. It's just smaller and costs more.
So I have these old coins that, I don't know, I guess they're not in circulation anymore, probably. Mm-hmm. There's a few advantages to my father being this vice president of the largest bank in Canada. Not that I have any more money than this. This is it. So a few coins.
Let me guess. Are they uncirculated pre-67 50-cent pieces, quarters?
Some of those. And that's really hard to determine. Well, some of them are foreign.
So Canadian coins, 1967 and prior, had 80% silver in them, other than the nickels. Dimes, quarters, 50-cent pieces, and dollars had 80% silver. In 1968, they got rid of the dime having silver. I think the quarters halfway through the year went to 50%, and then they phased silver out because the silver was, in fact, worth more at a certain point than the coin's face value was. So they ran into a wall and had to make copper nickel coins after that. So those are, in fact, very desirable. We buy them from the public, and they can be held on to as a source of silver. So you, in fact, have a head start. If you have some of those coins, you actually now have a silver collection. Many people keep those because they have a face value and they are recognized by everybody. It's very easy to teach somebody, hey, you know, this coin has 80% silver in it. In fact, I can show you on my cell phone here. I can look it up online and you can see that a 1964 silver dollar is 80% silver. And this is what it's worth in a transaction. So it can build a little bit of confidence. So if you have some of those, hang on to them.
Okay.
Hang on to them.
There's the sound of money. Well, it's hard to wrap this up because, you know, we all like to think and talk about money. So
it's true. It's your call, your show. It's up to you when we wrap up.
In the same box, I have all my teeth that my son lost in a little box. Are they worth anything?
But that's another one of those things where, you know, value is relative. No value to me. Unless they had gold crowns, which are 16-karat gold, and we do buy those.
Which they did with the Mayans back in the day. They put gold in the teeth of the special Mayan people. That's why they had all these gold and silver in their mouth.
Absolutely, because gold was soft and easy to work with.
But I do remember when my girlfriend's son, he lost a tooth and she put $20 under the pillow. I said, oh my God, what are you doing? You've just set a precedent.
20 times 32 plus inflation.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for that, Tom. I appreciate your research and all you've done in the world of money and gold and silver, precious metals.
Yeah, well, thank you all for hanging in here for over 2 hours. It's been quite a ride. Got a lot to think about. Now I have a lot to edit and put out on the podcast. So thanks for being part of it.
The work's just begun for you.
That's right.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me on. And thanks for all the questions, guys.
It's been great. All right, Tom. And thank you all. And we'll be in touch. I have your email, so I'll let you know when the podcast is ready and we can take notes and review again.
Great. Looking forward to it.
More questions than answers. That's the truth.